Welcome once again to JFK Spotlight on Health. This is where we highlight the groundbreaking work being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. It's part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. And today we're talking with Dr. Bob Lebovics, co-director of the JFK Advanced Lung and Airway Center. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning. Thank you so much. And it's really a pleasure and honor both to be here with you.
Yeah, I want to talk about the center for a while. I want to talk about the otolaryngology, which is a word you don't use very often. Could we define that exactly?
Otolaryngology is the technical term for my surgical specialty. Most people call it ear, nose, and throat surgery. It comes from the word oto, in Latin, Greek meaning ear, larynx meaning throat. Ology means study thereof. I've even seen some places they call it otorhinolaryngology, where they throw in the nose part for the rhino. But if you want to say ENT, that's fine. They don't stand up for malady.
Okay, ENT, and I'm just glad I pronounced it correctly, but we'll go with ENT because I could say that much better. And you're also head and neck, is that?
Head and neck surgery is part of the specialty.
Okay.
For example, within the specialty itself, there are sub-areas of sub-specialization. For example, pediatric ENT, there's otology, neurotology, which I would call advanced ear surgery or ear brain type surgery. Mm-hmm. That would be certain types of tumors that go into the brain and the ear, maybe cochlear implants. That's stuff that I don't do. That's a subspecialty that requires a lot of training expertise in the center.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about the center because that's where you are at the JFK Advanced Lung and Airway Center. Tell us the reason for having it and why it's so specialized.
Well, this for me is really a tremendous opportunity. I spent many years in Manhattan in the Mount Sinai system and had a wonderful time there. That was terrific. But I had a chance to join an old friend and colleague, Dr. Fez Bora, who's a thoracic or a chest surgeon.
Oh, sure. We've had him on the show. I've spoken with him. Yeah.
We used to work very closely together, and he's the other co-director of this center. And really, the thought here is that we want to treat people in a multidisciplinary fashion, because sometimes people think of things as being very compartmentalized when they're not. You know, you're not a voice box, you're not a windpipe, you're not a bronchus, you're not a liver, you're not an ear, you're not a knee. Every patient is a human being, and people have to understand there's a continuity or there is a overlap between organ systems, particularly things that are contiguous mm-hmm. or next to each other.
Sure, yeah.
In the case of what we do is we really, when my kids ask me what I do for a living, I have a very simple answer, which is sort of what I would say here is I help people breathe. Now, the respiratory tract really starts at the tip of the nose, and it ends really deep in the chest at the alveoli where the gas exchange occurs between the blood and the gases. Mm-hmm. And everything in between on some level contributes normally to normal physiologic breathing on the one hand and what we call ventilation. But on the other hand, any problems along that route can also contribute to pathology or trouble. Now, the focus of this center is really breathing from what we call the upper airways, which starts at the larynx or the throat, or maybe even the hypopharynx, the bottom of the throat.
Okay.
Because nasal disease is very important, but that's not the focus here in the sense that we can bypass that through our mouth. Part of the impetus, what this really involves, and I think this is really, I hope the beauty of what Dr. Bohr and I are going to recreate, is that there's an area in the middle called the trachea or the windpipe. Mm-hmm. Now, the upper windpipe, the voice box, clearly most people would say is in the domain of the ENT surgeons, and the lower trachea or the bronchi and the chest surgeon. There's sort of no man's land in the middle where, you know, you can say we both claim it or neither person claims it. There's overlap. And what we really want to do, or what we have done, is to try to come together, one from the north and one from the south, and together hopefully provide something that's more than the sum of the parts. It's really that simple. We have a lot of experience working together. And now this is obviously going to be in context and in conjunction with other medical specialists, lung doctors, for example, internal medicine specialists, primary care physicians, and in, you know, my case, immunologists, rheumatologists, certain types of cancer surgeons, cancer doctors, where there's a confluence of problems that affect people's ability to breathe.
Okay.
At the end of the day, that's what we facilitate, taking a big breath. My personal saying is, breathing is not underrated, and a lot of people take that for granted. So in a sense, that's what this center is all about. There are many groups of diseases that can affect this problem. Infection, inflammation, viruses. I mean, COVID itself is on some level a respiratory disease, as we all know, and have found that, unfortunately, over the last few years. Tumors, autoimmune diseases, inflammatory conditions, trauma, all these on one level or another can impact a person's ability to breathe. And depending on what the cause is, different types of treatment modalities will be implemented in order to facilitate that. Sometimes requires medicine, sometimes it requires surgeries, often it requires both. And we want to really get to that, not the next level, but the highest standard of what's the standard of care. And that's the primary purpose of this program. But now there's even a more important part.
Okay.
We had a chance, we want to advance the field, we want to advance the science. Dr. Warren and I were working on getting a lab going again. We used to do this when we were working together at Mount Sinai for some basic science work together with animal work. For example, a couple of years ago, we operated on about 30 pigs, putting in certain types of implants into the windpipe or the trachea, which were with certain constructs, some with stem cells, some without stem cells. We're growing them and learning how to regenerate windpipe tissue or respiratory tissue. We got a few published papers out of this. Part of what we're doing here at JFK, and we're thank God we're getting the support of the administration, for which we're grateful, is have a lab going, a basic science component. We're now going to connect with the medical school here to work at their research facilities there. And if we can take what we learn in the laboratory, basic science, and translate that into true benefit to human beings for patients, well, that's the next level, and that's ultimately really what this is all about. The buzzword they use now is regenerative medicine, and then you see that in all types of organs. They want to have maybe artificial pancreases to cure diabetes,
right,
or artificial livers for people in liver failure, et cetera.
And that's through stem cell.
And those were stem cells.
Yeah.
That we did and we will probably go forward with, but where you harvest stem cells from, whether you use autologous from that person or whether you use from, let's say, stem cell banks, is something, that needs to be clearly elucidated and worked on.
Mm-hmm.
But regenerative medicine is terrific. I had the privilege of working with a colleague at Mount Sinai, and he's a terrific guy, Dr. Jenden, and he did the first successful tracheal transplant in the world. And to say that this is awesome is unbelievable, but transplanting tissue is a lot more complicated.
Okay.
First of all, it requires a donor. And once you have a donor, that's one tragedy. But now the person has to deal with a lifetime of immunosuppression. They have to deal with a lifetime of basically preventing the donor graft from being rejected. And all that immunology is a whole science and problem to itself. If we can get a construct that can regenerate functional, and I stress the word functional, tissue within that windpipe, I mean, really, in my mind, that's really the holy grail.
So it's not as simple as regenerating tissue and then you just put in this new organ into somebody and they live happily ever after. It's a lot more intense than that.
At this point in time, you're correct. It's not even possible at this time. Although we have some thoughts, we have some papers, we're going to pursue the science and we see where it goes. And that's in addition to providing the state-of-the-art care for people who currently have a breathing problem.
Are we close to the way I just described it?
I like it tremendously, and I'm going to tell you why. Because at the end of the day, I'm not that smart. I'm just a surgeon. I'm just like a plumber in a sense. And basically, if we can put a new part in to replace what's broken and make it work, really, it's that simple. I mean, that's like I said, I think you hit the nail on the head. That's the holy grail here.
And you think it'll happen in our lifetime?
I hope so. I can't predict, but I was a little itty-bitty kid when they landed the first man on the moon, For my time, they split the atom, and then they decoded the genome, and now they're talking about going to Mars. And so I believe in the future. I think you need an imagination, you need a passion, and you run with it. And as long as you do it honorably and do it ethically, that's really what's critical.
Well, at the center, and we're talking about the JFK Advanced Lung and Airway Center, what would be the most common thing that you would deal with, the most common ailment, the most common problem?
So basically, from a medical perspective, or now it's like if you're in a hospital looking at codes that we're diagnosing, it's going to be laryngeal stenosis, tracheal stenosis, or bronchial stenosis. Stenosis means a narrowing of something. If you think of a windpipe as, let's say, an adult male in the middle, I don't know, it's 20 millimeters, 24 millimeters, somewhere along that line, and I don't want to argue the exact numbers in the average person.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine it gets narrower and narrower. And I give people the analogy. Imagine you have a straw, and you tell someone you got to pinch your nose, purse your lips, and just breathe through the straw. That might be 3 or 4 millimeters open.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell me how you feel after 5 minutes.
Right.
And I don't want to say it's that simple, but on some level, it's that simple. What happens is very few people go from completely normal to that level of stenosis. So there's a process and there's compensatory mechanisms. People exercise less. They walk up the stairs. They don't run up the stairs. You know, they spend less metabolic energy, or they have to breathe harder, you know, push the voltage to move the air in and out.
Mm-hmm.
So there are ways of compensating, and that's getting technical and into nuances. But at some point, if it's really narrow and you can't breathe, that's a problem. And if it's really acute, that's a life-threatening emergency. Sometimes they have to put a breathing tube in, intubate them in the emergency room or the operating room. Sometimes we have to put something called a tracheotomy in their neck,
right,
which is a tube through the skin into the windpipe, into the trachea to help them breathe. I spent a lot of my professional career so far trying to get these tracheotomy tubes out of people safely, and I stress the word safely. Like a lot of geopolitical issues, it's very easy to get involved in a problem. It's sometimes a lot harder to extricate yourself from that problem.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing with a trach. Sometimes it's very easy to put it in, but it's not that simple to get it out, at least in a safe fashion.
What causes the problem?
That's what we do primarily. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is, as part of that process, sometimes we have to come up with a diagnosis. Why did it happen? Because most people it doesn't. So if you're trying to figure out what's going on, well, there are diagnostic components, tests. Often it requires what's called a biopsy or a tissue diagnosis, and we can get that tissue, work with the pathologist.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, sometimes people have malignancies, cancers in their airway, and it's a very horrible, to see someone slowly suffocate to death is one of the most horrible things. I'm very proud to say that about 10 years ago, Dr. Bohr and I, we published a paper where we showed that we have certain types of stents that are put into the central airway, not only prolong life in these people, but it also tremendously enhances the quality of life, to be able to go home and take a breath and not be air hungry and be with your family. I mean, that's unbelievable in my view, you know?
Yeah, we've seen similar people, like when, maybe someone was a smoker and then they having to use oxygen because they can't take more than a few steps before they're out of breath. It's a similar feeling.
That's part of it.
Yeah.
But there's a big difference in those cases. And
okay.
That's sort of, whether knowingly or not, you brought up a great point in question. In pulmonology and what we do, you have to generally separate, and these were generally, separate the upper airway from the lower airways.
Okay.
And there's a lot of overlap here and some, wiggle points, but the upper airway is generally throat, larynx, windpipe, big
mm-hmm.
bronchi, and that falls in the domain of ENT, head and neck surgery, and thoracic surgery. As you get lower to people who have, let's say, bad emphysema, that's now getting into the world of pulmonology. That's a lower airway disease. And that's a whole different can of worms. And that's a very different process. And our center is actually including and trying to work with the lung doctors to see how we can help on those distal airway issues
mm-hmm.
for the lower airway diseases, which is on some level a medical problem more than a surgical problem. But again, nothing exists in a vacuum. We can't operate without the internal medicine doctors. They support us tremendously as we support them. But that's a very important distinction, upper airway obstruction from lower airway disease.
Right. And but the way I described it, is that the same kind of feeling that a patient would get when their airway is, they're not getting enough oxygen?
I mean, when you're air hungry, you're air hungry.
Right.
I believe it's the American Lung Association's motto is, and I hope I'm not misquoting that, it said, when you can't breathe, nothing else matters. And there's a lot of truth to that. It's a horrible feeling. Yes, any bad asthmatic in an emergency room is gasping for air. And that's a lower airway issue predominantly. It's one of the worst feelings when you fight for every breath.
We're talking with Dr. Bob Lebovics, JFK Advanced Lung and Airway Center, co-director there. What would be a more complex issue that someone would have that would be more difficult to treat?
Certain types of tumors that are affecting the airway, because you have the physiology of the airway process of moving the air, of running the pipes, and you have the oncologic or the cancer issues of doing it safely and trying to prevent spread or contiguous problems. So that's one major problem that can come up. And then also, like what I do particularly, is a lot of these rare autoimmune diseases, for example, systemic vasculitis, granulomatosis, polyangiitis, the names aren't that important. But what you have here are certain diseases where the inside of the lining itself is diseased. The voice box, the trachea, the bronchi, that we call it the endothelium or the epithelial layers, the respiratory tissue itself. When that's diseased, that's also a problem because you're dealing basically with an entire system that's impaired and requires concurrent treatments by other specialists, usually rheumatologists or immunologists or pulmonary specialists. And this is where I was alluding to the fact before that nobody does this in a vacuum. It's really a team approach and a team effort. From the surgical side, what Dr. Bohr and I are trying to do is make a major dent in terms of treatment and bringing state-of-the-art treatment here in Edison, New Jersey, and really to write the next chapter on what's going to be in the future. So we're here today, hopefully at the best that can be, and God willing, we're going to come up with something that in 5-10 years will be the state-of-the-art. People say, why didn't we have it back in 2023?
Right, yeah. There's so many things you look at that were like, I can't believe that we didn't come up with this sooner. And you just wonder what that next thing is going to be.
You're so correct. And science also requires a certain amount of faith, a certain amount of adventure and going forward. And you know what? Part of doing it is realize that it's never simple. There are always obstacles. Things don't work sometimes. I stress the word that these things have to be done honorably and ethically. You always have to, even in a standard procedure, get informed consent from a patient, let them know what's involved, what they're signing up for, the risk benefits. If anything is not standard, besides getting extra informed consent, it has to be run through what's called an IRB, an institutional review board, for safety purposes, for ethical purposes. And obviously, we want to adhere to the highest ethical and legal standards.
Talking with Dr. Bob Lebovics. He is the co-director of the JFK Advanced Lung and Airway Center. Now, you also do surgeries, which we've touched on. But what's your typical surgery look like? Run us through something that would be, I guess, if there is a routine surgery when it comes to this type of thing, and what the recovery time would be.
Okay, that's a great question. So first, there is no one way of doing things. It also depends on how acute the problem is. I mean, is someone gasping for air and it's now, you don't have 5 minutes, things like that occur, or something that's done electively in a planned fashion. That's number one. As a general principle, not only in what Dr. Bohr and I are doing endoscopically, but there's a general trend in medicine towards smaller incisions, like in the belly, laparoscopy, endoscopic approaches. We're even talking about maybe doing some robotics, because the smaller the incisions and the less trauma that's involved causes less side effects, faster recoveries, and obviously less risk. But to answer the specific question, what we generally do is we take someone to the operating room and we put them to sleep, or the anesthesiologist does that.
Right.
and he or she has to relax the patient, which is form of a muscle paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll go through the mouth with certain types of scopes. And it takes a lot of faith in working well with the anesthesiologist to do this because it's impaired airway, they're asleep, reflexes are not protected. If they're not able to breathe on their own because they're paralyzed, and you got to start operating, and then they don't have a breathing tube in there. So we'll do something called a suspension, or a laryngeal suspension, where we mm-hmm. put the scope in, lift up the voice box per se, and hook it up to a stand where everything becomes visible. At this point, we can actually sit and we can look.
Okay.
I always tell Dr. Bohr, for me, this is like a chess game. It's the opening move. It's setting up your board. Once I can see, I can either put a breathing tube in, sometimes use something called the jet ventilator, or the technical term is intermittent apneic oxygenation. I don't want to get into jargon here, but we put a little needle in where we can jet air in it. And as long as we can move air in and out on a small level, we can now oxygenate the patient for 5, 10, 20 minutes, whatever we need safely.
Okay.
Then the next thing we do is look. Sometimes we need, it depends on what we find. Sometimes we have to make cuts. We call them radial incisions. Sometimes we use injections of medicines, something called steroids. I rarely use something called mitomycin. There is a place for that. It's a chemotherapeutic agent that prevents scarring. A lot of what we are doing together, Dr. Bohr and I, are using cryotherapy now, where we have a special machine that actually freezes the tissue so it doesn't re-scar. Occasionally we use lasers, but less so at this point in time, because I just find the hotter it is, the more likely you are to cause other problems. But there is definitely a place for lasers. And if you could do this endoscopically, without having to cut through the neck and cutting through the soft tissues and opening the trachea from the outside, you're saving a lot of potential morbidity and risk to the patients.
Okay.
That might be a typical thing that doctor, in fact, I did one just the other day with Dr. Bohr. We suspended someone, used cryotherapy. We dealt with a lesion. Actually, we then took special types of balloons, tracheal balloons, which very powerfully open up these stenotic or narrowed segments. Now, sometimes we have to do open procedures. Let's say the middle of the trachea has a segment of three centimeters of scar tissue, and it depends on the patient. Let's say the patient doesn't have a cancer and does not have an autoimmune or systemic disease, local trauma from something, you can actually do what's called a tracheal resection, where externally, which is a big, you open the neck, you cut out a piece of the trachea above, a piece of the trachea below, and you connect them. They usually stay in the hospital for about a week or so till it heals. And when it goes well, it's a beautiful, beautiful operation. For technical reasons, the higher up it goes, when it gets past the first tracheal ring, it becomes technically a lot more difficult. And we have other procedures. Sometimes we do something called a Mattern procedure or a cricotracheal resection on the one hand. And if it gets very low below, where the lungs start splitting into the right and left lung, that's also complicated. The different kinds of stents we could use there. You can do certain types of partial resections of a bronchus and connect it to the trachea. That would be more for Dr. Bohra to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really much more complicated surgery. And the biggest problem with all this is length. And again, I don't like to argue exact numbers, but the mid-tracheal, 2-centimeter piece of scar tissue, I mean, you know, those are your slam dunks. You know, those are the ones.
Okay.
Yeah, you know. It's, I don't want to say it's easy because it's never a chip shot, but those you can do.
But that would not be the most common.
That would not be the routine. But the problem becomes when they become very long segments, let's say over, 7 centimeters, you probably can't get enough length to reconnect the trachea. And that brings us into the issue of regenerative medicine.
I see.
Once you put in place. But for our purposes, to come full circle and answer your question, is the most routine is a suspension examination and then using either scissors, cryotherapy, balloons, steroids, or often some combination thereof to open and repair a narrow stenotic segment.
All right, doctor. Thank you so much. Dr. Bob Lebovics, co-director of the JFK Advanced Lung and Airway Center. Thank you so much for speaking today.
Well, thank you so much for the honor and the privilege, and always be in touch. And if we have anything major to report soon, we'll call on you and hopefully we can give you an update.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you again, and my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Again, that's Dr. Bob Lebovics. He's the co-director of JFK Advanced Lung and Airway Center. If you'd like to make an appointment, you can call 732-635-9300 to schedule an appointment with Dr. Lebovics. Or go to jfkmc.org. If you want a podcast of this show, you can go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. This is JFK Spotlight on Health. I'm Joel Katz. It's brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better, and we'll talk to you next week.